And we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's dive in, starting with local and SPD, Seattle Police Department, public disclosures.
Yes. A King County Superior Court judge ruled this week that the city of Seattle can release the names of disciplined SPD officers. It was a question, really, of which would prevail, the Public Records Act and public disclosure requests or the union contract negotiated by the Seattle Police Guild that said that the city couldn't disclose for privacy reasons the names of officers who had been disciplined for misconduct. Judge Dean Lum ruled that the union contract literally can't trump state law. In January 2008, the city adopted recommendations of a citizens panel, which included releasing the names of officers after they'd been disciplined for misconduct. But the guild then brought a grievance against that policy, and an arbitrator ruled that the union was right, that they had negotiated a contract that would withhold those names, and therefore the city had to withhold them. Lum this week overturned that ruling and gave a victory to folks who have been searching for that kind of information and who have been filing public records requests with the SPD. Now, activists and folks who have been the victim of police brutality or or believe that they've been the victims of police brutality have been trying to get information out of the SPD, video dash cam footage, et cetera, in addition to these names. Those other public record request issues were not in part of this filing in front of the judge. It was only the names of disciplined officers. So,
all right. Moving on, information coming out this week that the tolls, predicted tolls for the tunnel will not be enough.
Yeah, the Washington State Department of Transportation released a report this week saying that the projected tolls on the downtown traffic tunnel will be only about 50% of the original projection. It was part of the funding plan for voters when they were deciding whether or not that the tunnel should pass. The state said that the tolls on the tunnel would raise about $400 million. Now they say it's going to be closer to about $200 million. Why? Well, they gave a couple reasons. One of the reasons was that it's a bad economy, therefore people are driving less. No kidding. And then they admitted, well, we assume with this new projection that people will avoid the tunnel so they won't have to pay the tolls. No, really.
And
it
this
took them this long to figure that out.
This was entirely predictable. And for evidence of this, one can only needs to turn to 520, where the traffic on 520 since the tolling began just after the Christmas holidays has literally dropped the traffic by between 40 and 50% on 520. Now this actually was anticipated on 520. And it's actually even worse than that, because with 520, you have to go several miles out of your way to find an alternative route. For the downtown tunnel, there's any number of alternative routes on surface streets going through downtown, and that's only a 1.5 mile stretch of tunnel that people are needing to avoid. And not only that, but the vast bulk of traffic on both the Aurora Avenue on the north side and State Route 99 on the south side going down towards SoDo is going into downtown, and the tunnel will not actually service downtown. There will be no downtown entrances or exits. So you can actually make the argument that the amount of traffic that's going to take the tunnel is going to be even less than this, but at least it is a recognition of somewhat predictable reality by the State Department of Transportation. The thing is that reality was intentionally, I think, suppressed in order to sell the building of the tunnel, which is not a transportation solution at all. It's a transportation rationale for a real estate development project.
Yeah. And it's just going to be a very, very expensive thing that we're not going to use very much. And when you think about it, the money could have gone for a whole bunch of other really good transportation projects around the state, not for something that's going to serve only a very small percentage of the traffic that was served by the viaduct.
And when the last thing I want to say about this is that when you're chipping away at the funding rationale for for this project even before the construction of the actual tunnel has begun. That's not scheduled to start until next year. They're working on the approaches to it now. Then you know that Mayor McGinn was correct to be concerned about cost overruns and who's on the hook for cost overruns, because those cost overruns are almost certainly going to happen. And not only cost overruns, but underruns in terms of the ability of the anticipated funding sources to actually pay for the construction.
Yeah, and you know, the Washington Department of Transportation says that federal money will plug this hole in the plan for budgeting for the tunnel. But the federal money that can plug a hole, that kind of a hole, is limited at about $219 million. This will take up most of that. So as Job said, if there are any other, you know, problems that come up in underfunding the project, well, then we're kind of at a loss.
And as Maria said, that's $219 million that would have gone to other projects.
Possibly, yes.
All right. Let's move on to Washington State Senate budget.
Yeah, this week the Washington State Senate came out with their answer to the budget. Now, remember, late last year, Christine Gregoire proposed a budget with lots of cuts, including cuts to education and to health care and human services. And then she proposed a 0.5% sales tax increase to buy back some of those cuts. A couple weeks ago, the House Democrats came out with their budget that had no sales tax increase in it, but it had big cuts for education again and for health and human services. Well, the Senate budget came out this week with no new sales tax increase, no cuts to education, and it also does an accounting trick that the House budget does. It delays $330 million in payments to schools by a day, pushing them into the next biennium, essentially making them the next budget's problem. And then it spends down more of the reserves, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I think in times when you're having trouble balancing the budget, that's when you use your reserves. And there's a good argument for spending down the reserves for this next biennium. But it closes a tax loophole for banks. That's a good thing to do. It also ends a tax break for wind power, which arguably is not a good thing to do. But it also has some cuts, though it makes no cuts to education. No further cuts to education. It cuts $28 million in healthcare, $87 million in human services, and about $18 million in natural resources. And there are some other cuts and consolidations mixed in there as well. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a good budget. I think there's probably a lot more work they could be doing in cutting some in closing some tax loopholes.
Yeah, although the Democrats actually tried to get that budget passed in the state Senate last night in anticipation of a deadline for financial related legislation to be passed in the legislative session before the end of the regularly scheduled session next week. And they failed because three Democrats joined the Republican caucus to stall the budget and propose a counter budget that would have deep cuts to Disability Lifeline, elimination of the state food assistance program. It does cut education. It actually does have funding for basic health plan, but it fully funds it. But it has a lot of the other cuts. And that unfortunately, if you remember the state Democrats selling out the teachers and the teachers union on mandatory testing a couple weeks ago so as to get the cooperation of the Republicans on this in the state Senate on passing the budget, well, that didn't work out
that
very well. but oddly enough, the teachers are still sold out.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen is we're going to have to go to a special session, because obviously the Republican alternative budget can't possibly be passed by the House, and so things are going to be stalled out, and we're going to go to a special session and do this negotiation stuff all over again.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting too that the governor was so off base with her budget proposal that neither House in the legislature managed to pick up what was the big selling point of her budget, the sales tax increase.
All right. Other developments down in Olympia?
Yeah, the Reproductive Parity Act, which was the act that would have required abortion coverage for a woman's health care coverage in private insurance plans, failed this week as part of the crossover votes that were lost due to endangering the Republican budget ploy in the state Senate. So that's DOA, but hopefully it'll come back again next year.
All right. And I know Jerry Paulette had put forward some legislation dealing with towing. Anyone follow that? Or
I didn't see how that came out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to.
And I don't know that the deadline for it was yesterday because it would have been revenue neutral.
And I want to say too, a lot of the freshman Democrats in the House have put forward some very interesting fiscal things, some very interesting budget of their own. Of course, it didn't go anywhere. But I find it interesting that the first term young Democrats in the House can come up with some really good ideas, but that none of them actually get into the budget. That's probably pretty typical for freshman legislators. They put out good ideas, but then it takes a term for them to realize that the good ideas don't always make it through.
Well, it also
the process.
It also shows you how ossified the Seattle legislative delegation has been. Because the Seattle delegation, since they're all pretty much safe seats in terms of the Democrats, can take the kind of risk that legislators in the rest of the state can't do. That sort of leadership should be happening among people from the Seattle delegation, regardless of how long they've been serving.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been happening for years and years.
No.
All right. On to our arena update, which I hope actually doesn't become a regular feature.
Yeah, let me tell you what happened in the game last night. Folks may remember that the much ballyhooed arena proposal that came up a couple weeks ago was contingent on getting both an NBA team and an NHL team, pro basketball and pro hockey. Well, the leading team in the pro hockey league, the National Hockey League, and the leading team in the National Basketball Association that were being discussed as possibilities to move, both of those were taken off the table this past week. The Phoenix Coyotes of the NHL got a new arena deal and ownership down there, and then the Sacramento Kings in the NBA, same thing, got a new arena deal approved in Sacramento. So this takes us back to square one in the arena deal. Now, bear in mind that all of the good proponent, good pieces of that proposal in terms of not requiring new taxes that directly affect taxpayers anyway, is contingent on that proposal being accepted by the hedge fund manager, Christopher Hansen, who's the private investor behind this deal. And he has said that would happen only if both the NBA and the NHL locate a team here. That's not going to happen, at least not for years to come that anybody can foresee. And so the most likely scenario, at this point, is that Hansen's going to go back and say, okay, in order to get this deal done, given that we don't have any guarantees of teams coming, I'm going to need guarantees from the city and from local taxpayers instead. So watch out for your pockets because they could still very easily get picked on this one.
Yeah. Well, and you look at it from the perspective of the NBA, for example, and the NBA commissioner could have at any time said, oh, you know, we can't really see a team locating to Seattle. I don't know why you guys are talking about an arena. But, of course, they didn't. At every opportunity when reporters asked them, they always said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. Even though you know that they knew no team was likely to move here. And it's really a way that they play the different cities off against each other to get – city of Sacramento to come forward and offer an arena, whereas it was pretty clear before Seattle jumped in and said, we're willing to build an arena to get your team, that the city of Sacramento wasn't all that interested in coming forth with an arena proposal. But as soon as Seattle jumped in, then suddenly things got moving in Sacramento. And it's really the way that that the NBA and these other sports organizations really manipulate the politics in these different cities to try to get what they want, which is ever bigger arenas, ever newer ones, built more frequently,
and with taxpayer money rather than the money of the owners.
More and more cash being shoveled into the sport in general.
All right, moving on to, that's a good segue for national, on to devastating tornadoes that hit this week.
Yeah, it was all over the news, the freak enormous superstorm that generated some 36 tornadoes over the course of February 29th and March 1st. What was really freaky about it was that this is not the typical tornado season for most of the Midwest, and that's precisely where the tornadoes hit. Tornadoes managed to hit in states from Kansas, Nebraska, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Kentucky, all the way to Tennessee, killing at least a dozen people or more. And setting some records, this really was the first time that a tornado had ever hit inside the state of Nebraska in the month of February. And, you know, this is not unusual. As the more you pay attention to freak weather events, the more you see that freak weather events are becoming more common. But of course, these superstorms are one of the major features predicted by global warming scientists. So I just want to point that out once again. You know, we hear lots and lots of news about the weather event itself, about the freak storms, about the damage that it causes, and almost no discussion of what could be the ultimate cause of these once in a lifetime or once in a century events happening on an annual basis.
All right. Moving on, study out this week about tasers.
Yeah, Amnesty International came out with a report that since 2001, 500 people in the United States have now been killed by law enforcement use of tasers in the U.S. The previous Amnesty report showing that 90% of the deaths by law enforcement were of unarmed people. Now, tasers have been really enthusiastically received by law enforcement agencies around the country, supposedly because they're non-lethal, but what we've seen in case after case after case is that these weapons are misapplied. They're not used in the way that they're supposed to be used. They're not used against resisting prisoners, but they're used as a form of suspect control or crowd control,
or in some cases punishment.
That's a way they're not supposed to be used, and that people are not well trained in how to use them. So what we're seeing is that these are not less than lethal weapons. They are in fact lethal weapons, and they need to start to be treated as such.
Yeah, obviously a weapon that kills about one person a week, has killed about one person a week over the past decade, can't really be termed a non-lethal weapon.
All right, moving on, HUD report this week.
Yeah, Housing and Urban Development Department of the federal government going after Bank of America this week, claiming that the BOA imposed unnecessary and burdensome requirements on any borrower who relied on disability income, that including requiring proof of disability, even though the getting onto, for instance, Social Security disability is already an exhaustive process that in many cases takes years and extensive documentations. Now, why this was a problem is that this was used to move the disabled if they couldn't meet those new and more burdensome requirements, to move the disabled from prime to subprime loans. And of course, since the disabled almost by definition are on fixed income, since they can't work and are relying on disability income, that leaves them vulnerable to foreclosure for balloon payments
and interest
increases that their fixed incomes can't cope with. So basically, it was a way to make sure that the disabled could be kicked out of their homes once they bought them.
That is slimy in so many ways.
And it obviously violates both the Fair Housing Act and the ADA. So the federal government going after Bank of America for this one, and hopefully it will be more than a cursory wrist slap the way so many of their punishments are.
Yeah.
All right. Moving then on to international, starting with Fukushima.
Yeah, some updates on the disaster at Fukushima. First we learned that scientists have discovered by taking measurements of cesium, radioactive cesium, in the waters off the coast of Japan, that the amount of cesium that was released by Fukushima, the power plant number one, was at least double what their previous estimates were. They estimated about 30 to 40 quadrillion becquerels were released shortly after the accident, whereas previous estimates said it was only maybe 20 becquerels. So that if that were not enough to disturb you, a report issued by a civilian investigative panel looking into how the Japanese government responded to the disaster at Fukushima right after the earthquake and tsunami found that if TEPCO had been allowed to do what they wanted to do, then we would have completely lost Japan. TEPCO wanted, in the wake of the disaster, to pull all of their personnel out of the Fukushima plant and just let it do its thing. That would have caused so much radiation.
Do its thing.
Just do its thing. That's exactly it. They wanted to evacuate all their personnel from the plant. They didn't want to address the problem at all. If they had allowed the plant to just do its thing, it would have released so much radiation that nearby power plants would have had to have been abandoned as well. They would have been left to do their thing, and then we would have had the government of Japan would have had to evacuate all of Tokyo and many other large cities. So what we were looking at in the worst case scenario would have been an abandonment of much of Japan to massive amounts of radiation. And it was only the intervention of Prime Minister Naoto Kan by going into the offices, the executive offices of TEPCO, and waving his finger at him and insisting that they keep their personnel there and address the problems at Fukushima and do their best to try to fix it, that literally saved the nation. And they were so close to the worst case scenario that I think people really need to pay attention to that.
You know, I have to say that kind of government intervention is really an assault on freedom. That they just let the free market work. That's what I say.
Yeah, big business.
Can you imagine an American president going into company offices and yelling at the executive saying, "You got to get your people in there and fix it." I don't know how well that would go down with American corporations.
Well, you know, you got to let the free market work.
Yeah.
That's the American way.
Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. Developments this week in Afghanistan.
Yeah, continuing protests, continuing lethal protests in Afghanistan that have been really painted in American media primarily as those crazy Afghans complaining about the disposal of some books. It's a little more complicated than that, of course, and it is a little more nuanced than that. But first of all, about the disposal of those books, it wasn't that long ago in this country that you had politicians demagoguing and demanding laws and even demanding a constitutional amendment around flag burning, which is, you know, in many ways a less loaded example of the value of a symbolic object than as a holy book.
Or burning a book in general, any book.
Yes, exactly. So when you hear, well, it's only those heathen savages who could get this worked up about something so trivial. No, it's not. We do it in this culture too. But beyond that, these are not just protests about cultural insensitivity around the disposal of the Quran. It's also Marines urinating on Afghan corpses. It's also the deaths of time after time after time of children in bombing runs and drone attacks. It's also
breaking down people's doors in the middle of the night,
lying about casualties and stonewalling about U.S. assaults on civilians.
Yes, people disappearing into the U.S. anti-terrorist gulag system and their relatives never being able to find out where. Is my son being held? How can I get him released?
And people being held for years in that way.
Yeah.
And this has been going on for over a decade now, and people are, not surprisingly, tired of it. Mm-hmm. This is what's going on in Afghanistan, and because we're not hearing day after day after day in the news about these ongoing assaults against the dignity and in many cases the lives of Afghan civilians, it seems to come out of the blue to us when these explode in these sorts of protests. But for people who have been following what's going on in Afghanistan, people who understand what the circumstances are there, this is not surprised at all. The surprise is that it's not happening on more on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me too. You know, the latest attack against U.S. troops there in Afghanistan was a guy who was the head of a platoon, an of an Afghan platoon, and a civilian translator or a civilian literacy teacher who was teaching Afghan soldiers on the base how to read. These two guys pulled guns and shot American soldiers. So it's not, as we're hearing from the U.S. military spokesman, it's not, oh, these are Taliban, you know, these are Al-Qaeda members. It's members of the Afghan military, and some of them very trusted members of the Afghan military. And it really points out that the U.S. troops there are not fighting Al-Qaeda anymore. They are basically fighting the conservative wing of the indigenous population. That's what we're doing there.
All right. Leaves us a couple minutes left to talk about North Korea.
Yeah, this week North Korea announced that it was willing to suspend its uranium enrichment project in exchange for food aid. Now, this comes from the new premier of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, the son of Kim Jong-il, who recently passed away. And it's being seen as a good sign, although the U.S. Was very quick to point out, well, they didn't say anything about their plutonium plant at Yongbyon. They said they'd let inspectors into their new uranium enrichment plant, but it really is a way that the North Korean government is trying to reach out to become part of the international community again. But you gotta realize too that they're a little leery. They had this kind of agreement before with the Clinton administration way back in the 1990s that they would suspend the work at Yongbyon if the Clinton administration would allow food aid into North Korea, and yet they couldn't get the deal actually done, because even though the U.S. government and North Korea agreed on that deal, Congress didn't follow through with the food aid.
The United States reneged on the food aid portion of that.
Yeah, yeah. And that scuttled that deal with Kim Jong-il. Well, this is his son now, Kim Jong-un, and we have a chance to start over again. And I think the U.S. really needs to be serious about this. We'll see if the Obama administration really is serious about following through.
All right. Events.
Yeah, tonight at 7 o'clock at Kane Hall, room 120 on the beautiful University of Washington campus, the Western Washington Chapter of Physicians for National Health Program are holding their annual meeting, and Amy Goodman will be there for that. Also, Dr. Quentin Young and Teresa Mosqueda will be speaking, so that's worth checking out. And then on Saturday, I believe it is, Saturday as in today, 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, the Fairmount Olympic Hotel, 411 University Street, Occupy Seattle, will be doing a protest around the Komen Foundations and their policies around women and gender equality and related issues. Again, that's tonight from 6 to 8 o'clock at the Fairmount Olympic Hotel downtown.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where people find Eat the State. And where do people find Maria?
People can find me. Sometimes I post to the Eat the State website, but I always post to my own website, mariatomchik.com.